May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Paul Fioravanti for petitioners below, appellees. I'd like to introduce to the Court Mr. Tom Jamieson, who is my corresponding counsel, who has been admitted pro hoc vice and will be presenting oral argument on behalf of petitioners below, appellees.
Welcome to the Court, Mr. Jamieson.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Mr. Dent.
Good morning. May it please the Court. In his first trial following his appointment to the bench and in his first exposure to corporate valuation methodologies, including discounted cash flow and comparable company analyses, the Vice Chancellor did a commendable job. The Vice Chancellor quickly grasped both the concepts and the mechanics of the various valuation methodologies utilized by the experts. And the opinion demonstrates that he became sufficiently conversant with those methodologies that he was able to perform his own independent discounted cash flow valuation. Now, based on the trial record, the Vice Chancellor derived several inputs for his valuation that were independent of those propounded by the party's experts, including terminal value, an appropriate level of net cash for operations, and the discount rate, none of which have been appealed by either side. In addition, he carefully scrutinized the petitioner's comparable company analysis and appropriately rejected that analysis in this case. Now, although the trial court demonstrated competence in utilizing sophisticated valuation methodologies to reach a fair value determination, the court made two errors that significantly affected its ultimate valuation. Now, those errors flowed not from a misunderstanding of the concepts underlying or the application of the discounted cash flow methodology, but from errors of law and invalid assumptions that ultimately affected the court's per share valuation. Those two errors involved, one, a failure to assess the credibility of the management forecasts reflected in management's 2002 budget, which was adopted by the court for purposes of determining future cash flows, and the rejection of the several market-based indicators of value as reasonableness checks on the court's valuation. Now, I would like to first turn to the trial court's failure to assess the credibility of management's 2002 budget and its failure to discount as appropriate those projections to reflect their lack of support in the historical operations of the company, the inexperience of new management, and the nascent nature of the company's new business plan. Now, as a matter of law, Section 262 requires the trial court to take into account all relevant factors. And as the Delaware courts have noted, the quality of the inputs used in a discounted cash flow valuation will determine the validity of the valuation. As a consequence, eMachine submits that as a matter of law, before utilizing forecasts prepared by management for purposes of determining cash flow inputs or inputs for its DCF valuation, the court must ensure that those management-prepared forecasts have sufficient support to justify their use. And in this instance, we submit the Vice Chancellor did not do that. In fact, the Vice Chancellor himself suggested that there were factors in this case that would justify adjusting the budget before utilizing that budget as a valuation tool. At pages 17 to 18 of the trial court's opinion, the court noted that it, quote, had reservations about applying a DCF model in the present circumstances where projections for only 1 year are available and the relevant operating history is equally limited. He went on to note that he was, quote, compelled in these circumstances to proceed cautiously using a DCF model.
But at the end of the day, the Vice Chancellor said that your client's efforts to undermine the 2002 budget only served, quote, to discredit the credibility of your client's entire presentation. So when we've had a trial and the Vice Chancellor makes that credibility assessment and decides I'm just not going to be able to credit their presentation, what do we do? What's our standard of review?
Your Honor, in this instance, I submit that the standard of review is mixed question of law and fact, because in the issue that's been presented to this court, the issue is whether or not, as a matter of law, the court needs to essentially kick the tires of the management forecast and determine if that valuation has support. What the vice chancellor did was, and he very clearly was offended by Mr. Anderson, the CFO's testimony that the budget was aspirational. Mr. Anderson testified that the new management team, which had just been brought in 1991 to run the company, had never run the company, had never before prepared a budget for the company. New management was confident that it was going to be able to meet these forecasts. But he recognized that there were risks inherent in that. Now, whether or not the trial court was offended by Mr. Anderson's testimony that the budget was aspirational really is a red herring, because the court, in our view, is required as a matter of law to determine whether or not there is support for the budget. So if Mr. Anderson came in and said, I have 100% confidence in this budget, or if he said, I don't believe this budget at all, it doesn't affect the court's requirement, the requirement on the part of the court to look at the factors and determine whether or not the budget should be used.
Didn't the court look at the methodology of bottoms up and top down and evaluate it, that it was a business as usual plan?
The court certainly, that's what management said, and the court took that into account. But remember, Justice Ridgely, this was the first budget ever prepared by this management team. It was a new management team, and it was an entirely new plan for this company that had been failing. And in the summer of 2000, after it had been delisted on NASDAQ, people were counting this company out. The board authorized CSFB to go and try to find a buyer. They contacted 55 potential buyers, and only one, Gores, was at all interested in making an offer, and then only at 81 cents a share. So this is all leading up to the implementation of this new plan, which was still ongoing at the time of the merger.
Well,
so,
isn't it a fact that at the time of the merger, the company had $180 million in cash and no debt?
I think that's right. I think there was some trade debt, and I think the court took that into account and concluded that the net cash was somewhere around $160 million. But that's correct.
And one of the things that affected the Court of Chancery's credibility assessment was that your suggested value was really less than the cash value of the company, wasn't it?
It was, Your Honor, but that's not uncommon in cases where a company has had a difficult trading history. We cited the Sisyph case, for example, where a company has had a troubled financial history. And where there are essentially are a lot of risks that we have here, such as new management and a new plan and all of those things, they can be taken into account in determining what the future value of this company is.
But as you well know, having litigated appraisal cases for a couple of decades, we're talking about the operating reality, what's known, not speculative, on the date of the merger. And on the date of this merger, it was important to the vice chancellor that they had $180 million in cash and no debt. And he just had trouble with your client's position that, notwithstanding this, the company was worth less than its cash value.
No question, Your Honor. But our position is it should be up to the vice chancellor to determine whether or not there should be adjustments made to the budget, and if so, what those adjustments should be. And what the vice chancellor said in his opinion was, the vice chancellor acknowledged in the opinion that eMachines had argued that there should be appropriate discounts. He then, in his opinion, in our view, never took that up. What he said was the 2002 budget, which was finalized in February, was the best indicator of value of the company as of the merger date, and therefore he was utilizing the budget. And our position is that as a matter of law, he missed the second step. He then needed to then say, okay, based on all the evidence, the cash, the what's happened in the past, new management, whatever other factors are in the record, he was required to make a determination of whether or not that budget should be relied upon, or if not, if there should be adjustments made to it. This is not a novel proposition. We have cited the Technicolor case that Your Honor, I believe, was referring to, and in the most recent iteration of that case, Chancellor Chandler concluded, well, let me step back. The case was at the trial. The Technicolor argued that the company should be valued utilizing a 1983 calendar year forecast that had been prepared 2 years after the two months after the merger, and on the basis that it was prepared as normal under the original Kammerman, the earlier management plan. And petitioners argued that in light of the fact that the court was now required to value the company under the new management or the Perlman plan, the court needed to look at other things such as what was going on in the industry to determine whether or not it was appropriate to continue to use the calendar year forecast to project. Chancellor Chandler concluded, he ruled otherwise, and he said that given that there was the history that management had in the past utilized this calendar year forecast and they had adopted methodologies, they had forecast from this type of work, and that those methodologies were reasonable and he found no reason to deviate, he said, in this instance, I'm going to continue to use the calendar year forecast.
Well, let me put my question in perspective. And the vice chancellor valued the company in accordance with the statute, brought his independent expertise to bear in that. And you were moving him in a certain direction, and they were focusing on the management budget to move him in the other direction, and he came out at a point that you disagree with. But on appeal, we have to factor into review the vice chancellor's concern that your client wasn't even willing to say the company was worth its cash value on the date of the merger. And that seemed to begin the unraveling of the vice chancellor giving any credence to your arguments and moved him a lot towards management's budget.
Your Honor, I do believe that the cash value, the net cash, which is the number that the court reached, was actually less than the 150 more million times the dollar sick per share. It was very close. But again, I don't want to repeat myself. We submit that the court didn't take the second step. And I don't mean to suggest that on remand the vice chancellor couldn't look at all of this and come up with essentially the same number. Our point is that he didn't make that second step. We don't believe it's appropriate for this court to do so. We believe that the trial court needs to take a look at that.
Well, didn't he implicitly say there's no need to discount it because of the methodology and the fact that it was, as to how it was adopted and the research that went into that, notwithstanding the lack of historical data under this business plan?
Justice Ridgely, I'm not sure I agree. I think he said he was adopting the plan, and he did go through and explain why management thought it was a reasonable plan. But that's an independent inquiry we submit. We believe that the court has its own independent obligation to assess the credibility of those numbers. And an earlier decision of Technicolor, I think, really bears that out. As you'll recall, in 1990, former Chancellor Allen valued Technicolor under the Kammerman plan. And in that case, Chancellor Allen valued the one-hour photo operation. Now, one-hour photo was slated for disposition under the Perlman plan, but then Chancellor Allen valued one-hour photo because he was valuing the Kammerman plan. And in that case, Technicolor's expert, Professor Rappaport, valued the one-hour photo business on the assumption that one-hour photo was going to continue. And what he did was he took Technicolor management's forecasts for one-hour photo, and then he heavily discounted them. And Chancellor Allen agreed with that. What he said was, and I'm quoting, this is from 1990 Westlaw 161084 at Star 23. He said, I'm convinced that management's forecast was overly optimistic and that Professor Rappaport's base scenario is the most reliable valuation of the business and therefore deserves greater weight than the management forecast. I do not lightly criticize management's one-hour photo forecasts. As a general rule, I'm of the view that management projections done for real-world purposes are deserving of substantial weight. The following reasons, however, lead me to conclude that Professor Rappaport was reasonable in heavily discounting the management plan. One, management had no experience in the one-hour photo business and no track record in forecasting the business prospects. And two, the industry itself was in its infancy and faced uncertainty and risks. We submit that that's exactly what the trial court, as a matter of law, is required to do, to assess those factors. And we submit that the vice chancellor did not do that. Yes, he was persuaded that the budget was adopted as a proper exercise of management. But again, he independently was required to make a determination as to whether or not that budget was fully credible, notwithstanding the fact that the new management team believed it was. We also cited in our papers the Doff versus Travelocity case, in which Vice Chancellor Lamb reached a similar conclusion. He determined that management forecasts should not be relied upon due to the limited financial history of Travelocity. And the parties disagree over the extent to which that case is applicable.
You mentioned the new management team, but in his opinion, the vice chancellor mentions that they had some success in turning around the profitability. And to a certain extent, he was just extrapolating their projected success.
I think that's right, Your Honor. But I think, as a practical matter, the court never then took a look at where the curve was in terms of where things were going and how that compared with the budget. And the testimony from Professor Jarrell and also from the who was E-Machines expert and also Mr. Anderson was the budget was a huge different from anything that they had experienced as of the merger date. So once again, we think that that is something that the trial court can consider. The trial court appropriately may consider the extent to which this new business plan and the implementation of that plan as of the merger date sort of coincides with or sort of projects the future and compares with the 2002 budget. But we think in the first instance that has to be done or should be done by the trial court and was not done in this case.
And articulate your basis for relief. Was there an abuse of discretion, an error of law, incorrect fact-finding? What are we going to be saying in an opinion if we're going to have this redone?
In this view, we submit it as a mixed question of fact and law. There was an error of law in that the court failed to make that step to specifically address the credibility of the 2002 budget for use as a forecasting tool. And to the extent that that budget required adjustments or discounts, it was an error for the court not to engage in that effort to adjust or discount that budget so as to permit its use in the discounted cash flow valuation.
Well, I'm having problems following that because if the court accepted the 2002 budget, doesn't that address its credibility?
I submit not, Your Honor. The Vice Chancellor concluded that it was the most reasonable, it was the best evidence at the time of the merger of what was forecast. But whether or not it was the best evidence at that time doesn't necessarily mean it has to be relied upon or can't be adjusted by the court to reflect circumstances that were not appropriately taken into account that the court needs to do in satisfying its statutory mandate under Section 262. And I think that the decision from former Chancellor Allen in the Technicolor case bears that out. Once again, that was what the court concluded was management forecasts that were utilized by Professor Rappaport were an appropriate starting point, but they required.
I'm reading page 26 and 27 of the opinion, and the Vice Chancellor says, therefore, the court views the 2002 budget as the best available projection of net profit for 2002 based on what was known or knowable on December 31st, 2001. So this appears to be the Court of Chancery saying, I've heard all of the evidence, I've assessed the credibility of the witnesses, I've heard their experts' testimony, and this is my finding.
I submit, Your Honor, that's not what the court was saying there. But the court, one of the issues that was before the court in this at this stage was whether or not to use an earlier iteration of the budget or to use the budget that was finalized in February. And E-Machine's position at the trial court was you couldn't use the report or the budget as of February because that was post-merger. But in our rebuttal report, we then said, well, if you choose to do that, we then showed particular adjustments that could be made. And I submit what the court is saying there is we have to start with the 2002 budget. It is the best evidence to start from. But again, we submit that the court then didn't engage in that second step. I don't want to use all of my rebuttal time. I would just point out that the other issues are with regard to the failure or the rejection of the reasonableness tests. We submit that if the court does remand for reconsideration of the value after considering the credibility of the 2002 budget, we submit that the court should also then reconsider the reasonableness checks. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors, and distinguished guests. May it please the Court, my name is Tom James, and I represent Charles and Michelle Goal, the petitioners and appellees in this matter. My clients and the other shareholders who dissented from the E-Machines merger did so because they believed that the merger price of $1.06 per share did not reflect the fair value of E-Machines as of the merger date. And they were proven right. as the Court of Chancery ruled that the fair value of E-machines at the time of the merger was $1.64 per share. This was an independent valuation by the trial court that came in higher than E-machines' expert's valuation and lower than our expert's valuation. Now, obviously, we're here today because E-machines is not happy with Vice Chancellor Parsons' valuation. But E-machines' disappointment is simply not a sufficient basis to overturn the Court of Chancery's well-reasoned opinion. It seems even E-machines had trouble finding errors in that opinion because the two alleged errors it has appealed fall so far below the standard for reversal that it is remarkable that we are even here today. But I'm pleased that we are here today because I truly enjoy talking about this case. Now, it's clear from the panel's questions that the court has thoroughly reviewed the party's submission. So rather than simply repeat what the court has already read, I will limit my remarks to a few key points. The first topic of my argument will be the standard of review, and then I'll discuss why neither of the two factual findings challenged by E-machines should be reversed, as they are manifestly supported by the record. Now, when we wrote our standard of review section for our brief, this court had not yet issued last month's decision in Mr. Dent's now infamous CD case. That timing was unfortunate for us because if that opinion had been issued before we completed our brief, it would have been the only case we would have cited for our standard of review section. And that's because that single case reaffirmed precisely what we said in our papers about the standard of review on this appeal. For instance, the court said in that case that a court of chancery's fair value determination is accorded a high level of deference on appeal. It said the court reviews appraisal valuations pursuant to an abuse of discretion standard, so long as the court of chancery has committed no legal error.
Mr. Davison, you realize the three justices that are hearing your case are the same three justices that heard that case?
I am, Your Honor. Obviously, that's come to my attention since the panel sat before this. But I did want to make sure, I did want to highlight those points. But if you think they do not need to be highlighted, given the members of this panel, I will certainly move on.
Well, you mentioned timing. Fortunately, it was only a month ago, so we haven't forgotten it yet.
Well, that's a comfort to me, because it appears Mr. Dent forgot about it already, and he was there. Well, given the restatement of the high deference that this court gives to the Court of Chancery's appraisal decisions, it simply cannot be fairly argued that the applicable standard of review on this appeal is anything short of abuse of discretion, especially in light of the two determinations challenged by E-machines. Now, E-machines has raised two issues on appeal. First, it claims that the trial court erred by failing to discount the 2002 budget projections that management prepared in the ordinary course of business contemporaneous to the merger. And second, E-machines claims that the court gave insufficient weight to certain reasonableness checks proffered by E-machines experts. Plainly, the standard of review for both of these factual determinations is abuse of discretion. And under that standard, the court's factual findings may be reversed only if those findings do not have support in the record or the court's valuation is not the result of an orderly and logical deductive process. E-machines has simply failed to meet its heavy burden to show that Vice Chancellor Parsons abused his discretion, either when he chose not to tamper with management's 2002 budget projections or when, after weighing the reasonableness checks proffered by E-machines expert, he decided that they did not undermine his fair value determination. Both of these factual determinations were made after the court weighed evidence and made credibility determinations. As Justice Holland has noted repeatedly already this morning, and those determinations were fully supported by the record and clearly the product of an orderly and logical deductive process. I'll start with the court's acceptance of the 2002 budget. Vice Chancellor Parsons spent 9 pages of his opinion making detailed references to the record and carefully explaining the many reasons that led him to adopt the 2002 budget projections, and I won't repeat those here. He dealt repeatedly with the very issues that Mr. Dent has raised here this morning. And those discussions can be one of those sections of the Court of Chancery's opinion is contained in a footnote on page 26, and I believe it's footnote 71 of page 26, and I'll read from that because it addresses these issues. He says, the company also argues that the 2002 budget was unsupported by the company's past performance. That criticism, however, would apply to any forecast of eMachines' earnings at the merger date, since the merger took place less than a year after the new management team was put in place and only 7 months after it implemented an entirely new business plan.
Well, why shouldn't there be some discount of at least a small number of percentage points under that circumstance?
Well, this panel, if it heard the case at trial, could certainly come to that conclusion. However, there's nothing about an inexperienced management team that necessarily calls for a discount in its projections. Maybe the management team was so inexperienced it had no idea how good the company could actually be. Maybe it under-projected when it put that budget together. Maybe the business plan was going to be far more successful than the new management team actually realized. These are the type of endless conjectures that would necessarily follow if Mr. Dent's argument were to prevail. At some point, we have to trust management because management is in the best position to determine, to assess the capabilities of the company and assess its own capabilities.
So if they're good enough, there's no need to discount anything at all, then.
I would say that the court would have discretion to discount that if the court so chose. But there's absolutely no authority for Mr. Dent's proposition that is that a court of chancery abuses its discretion when it decides not to tamper with management's projections. And that's what we're here today to talk about, not whether or not the Court of Chancery necessarily got everything right in its opinion. I happen to think that on that point it was exactly right. Those were management's best estimates of what the company was going to do. You could argue that maybe it was going to do better than that. In fact, it did. It exceeded those projections. Or maybe it was going to do worse than that. But those were management's best forecast, and that's why he used it. And he considered all the relevant factors, the pros and cons about whether or not he should discount from that. And he didn't discount from it. And the question for this court is not whether he was right or wrong to not discount or enhance those projections, but whether or not it was an abuse of discretion for him not to tamper with those projections. And I submit there is nothing in the record or prior cases by this court that suggests that the Court of Chancery abused its discretion when it did not tamper with those projections.
Well, I may have missed Mr. Dent's point, but I thought his point was the statute required the vice chancellor to discount.
I think the only thing the statute says is that it needs to consider all relevant factors. The statute doesn't say anything about discounting management's projections.
If there were language in the statute that could be interpreted that way or case law that suggested that it should be, would it then be simply an abuse of discretion for him to fail to follow the statute or an error of law?
I don't want to speculate on what is or is not in the statute because the statute is clear and it says...
Well, the statute says known and susceptible of proof on the date of the merger.
Right. Correct. There's nothing in there that requires a court to discount management's budget. And there's a long line of cases that says you don't tamper with management's budget. And there's nothing in that statute that says you have to discount from management budgets. What he's trying to do is determine for his discounted cash flow analysis what is the best forecast to go on based on information that was known or knowable at the time of the merger.
So, as I understood the argument in your brief, to the extent the budget was susceptible of proof, It was based on the success in turning around the company to date, and the vice chancellor concluded that the budget was a logical projection of continued success.
That's correct. That's correct. In fact, that's what the record shows. In fact, this management team was so important for this company that when Director Hoy purchased the company, enormous equity stake in the enterprise if they continued on as management team. That's what Director Hoy thought of this management team. So he was quite confident that the management team was going to be able to execute its plan.
What was the argument before the Vice Chancellor as to the percentage of discount for the 2002 budget, if any?
Well, that's a great question, because there was no such argument. There was never any argument made by E-Machines in this case at the trial court that the court should discount X amount from these budget projections. There were only two sets of projections this entire case that were really talked about. One was the management case, which is what E-Machines publicly disclosed as its 2002 projections. And then there was the 2002 budget projections that projected operating income for 2002 13 times higher than what management disclosed to the public when it was asking the public to sell their shares to Director Hoy. And the 2002 operating budget projected operating margins 9 times higher than the projections that it publicly disclosed when the merger was announced.
So are you saying this issue was not fairly presented to Vice Chancellor?
I certainly don't think that there's anything in the record to suggest that issue was presented or that any appropriate discount was discussed to the Vice Chancellor. No one ever suggested to the Vice Chancellor, okay, we'll live with the 2002 projections, but we want you to discount it by 25% because of the new management team. No one ever suggested that. In fact, all Mr. Dent tried to do in this case, and E-Machines had tried to do in this case, and I understand why they tried to do it, was to get the projections out because they didn't like it in a motion to eliminate, and that's not necessarily part of this argument. But those were the only...
What the Vice Chancellor had before him apparently were undisputed facts, that there was a company with $160 to $180 million in cash, no debt, a new management team that had turned the company around and was projecting where it was going to go in the future.
Correct. That's correct. Those were undisputed facts. And, in fact, when they tried to dispute those facts, that's when Mr. Anderson came up and started saying how aspirational this budget was and what a Hail Mary this budget was at trial. And given the extensive record that was in this case in terms of internal company documents, the process of preparing that budget, and Mr. Anderson's deposition testimony a year prior to the trial, all of those things led Vice Chancellor Parsons to conclude that Mr. Anderson's attempts to discredit the budget were less than credible, and he has that quote in his opinion. And I think that probably more than anything speaks to what the standard ought to be here. This was based on credibility determinations by the Court of Chancery, and that means it's an abuse of discretion standard. And I do want to highlight, and I know that opinion is fresh in your mind, but one of the things that this panel said in the most recent CD case is that the court will defer to the Court of Chancery's factual findings so long as they are supported by the record, even if this court might independently reach an opposite conclusion. So even if this court, if it stepped into the shoes of the Court of Chancery, would have discounted the 2002 budget or enhanced the 2002 budget. The fact that Vice Chancellor Parsons did not, it simply is not an abuse of discretion, and it is not grounds for reversal. I see that I am running out of time. I did want to mention the reasonableness checks quickly. Counsel has essentially conceded that this is a waiting issue. He's asked the trial court to remand this case and instruct the trial court to apply appropriate weight to the reasonableness checks, whatever appropriate weight means. And when we're talking about weight, we're talking about abuse of discretion. Vice Chancellor Parsons spent six pages discussing his analysis of the reasonableness checks. I won't go into that detail here. E-Machine's biggest complaint seems to be that the court speculated as to the motivation of some of the insiders who tendered their shares. Of course, that so-called speculation was all based on facts in the record. And furthermore, it is no more speculative than assuming the insiders all tendered their shares because they all believed the merger price reflected the fair value of E-Machines on the merger date. As E-Machines points out, the insiders were not deposed by either side in this case, so the record as it stands is all we have or all the trial court has on that issue. But one fact is clear, and that is undisputed, and that is that none of the insiders, none of the potential outside bidders, and the public had access to the 2002 budget, which contained management's real expectations for the company on December 31st, 2001, the merger date.
So isn't it speculative to conclude that AOL and others wanted to create a liquidity event?
Well, I think when you have evidence and you weigh that evidence, you come to certain conclusions based on that evidence. And one of the conclusions that the court came to when it looked at that was that this AOL had made this investment for because it was being a partner with E-Machines, and that partnership had failed, and E-Machines and AOL no longer had a business relationship, and that they may have wanted an exit strategy. But that's besides the point, because what we do know is that they never had the real information that Director Hoy had as of the merger date about what management's real expectations were for the company. So none of those reasonableness checks have any bearing on what the fair value of this company was as of the merger date, because things had changed so dramatically, as evidenced by the 2002 budget and what management really planned to do with the company, which, of course, is why Director Hoy purchased the company. In conclusion, the Court of Chancery's determination with respect to the 2002 budget and the reasonableness checks are supported by the record and are plainly the result of an orderly and logical deductive process, and for this reason, they should be affirmed. That's all I have. Thank you.
Just a couple of points. Mr. Jamieson says things changed so dramatically, and that's reflected in the 2002 budget. His own expert testified, conceded at trial, that nothing at the company changed between November, when the transaction was approved, and the merger date in December 31, except the internal budgets that was this fluid process of ongoing preparation of the budget. Nothing changed. It makes a big deal of saying that, well, the shareholders weren't told about the budget. This was an internally generated budget process that went through until February of 2002. And the only thing that changed was management became more confident, more optimistic in preparing that budget. But it wasn't based on any changes in the industry or changes in the business or changes at the company, which is what their own expert conceded. With regard to Justice Holland's question about the budgets, at page 26, I think it's clear that what the court is saying there is we're talking about utilizing the 2002 budget as finalized in February rather than an earlier iteration, because that's in the context of the court's the argument about which valuation should be utilized. And even in that instance, the court says that the court has frequently expressed a preference for management's forecast when they're supported by evidence, and we submit that he didn't, and then make that second step to look at whether or not there is evidence. The question, Chief Justice, you asked about the requirement of discounting. We submit that there is a requirement as a matter of law for the court to look at what is supporting those management forecasts. The statute doesn't say you have to adjust them, but we believe the statute properly interpreted requires consideration of whether or not there is support and what the support is, and make a factual determination that there is support, therefore they don't need to be adjusted, or that there might be some adjustment required to reflect factors that aren't taken into account.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dent.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your briefs and arguments. We'll adjourn for the day after welcoming, after the argument, the members of the Corporate Laws Committee of the ABA. Thank you, Chief Justice Vesey, for inviting the group, and thank you for containing your excitement during the course of the argument. We are adjourned.
All manner of persons having anything before the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware may now depart and give their attendance to the call of the court. The court is now adjourned. God save the state and the honorable court.